Succession number 28361, reel 51.
General Julian Thompson, reel 51. You were saying that your chaps there were keeping watch, that they had some night vision device, and also that they could use moonlight or starlight.
Yes, in this very, very yellow grass in the winter, which is not green, it's yellow, bright yellow, rather like the desert, you can actually see a long way at night if there's any ambient light at all.
Well, so the yellow grass reflects what light there is.
Yes.
And you'd be able to see shadows moving,
sure,
I suppose.
Sure.
Yes.
The only problem, I may have told you this before, in which case stop me, is that because there's no trees or buildings around for reference, it's very difficult to get an idea at night of how far away things are and how big they are. And before we landed naval gunfire support chaps, ready to talk to the ships when we were landing, and one of them, William McCracken, was lying in his OP and thought he saw an Argentine patrol approaching. It turned out to be a bunch of penguins, because he had no reference at night for how tall these things
couldn't
were.
Assess the height of them.
No.
Did he bring down gunfire?
No. He just hoped that they wouldn't see him. No, he didn't. No, they weren't all that far away. I mean, he thought that these sort of things that high,
About three foot high,
which were actually quite close, were 6 foot people twice the distance away, because he had no means of, you know.
Was there any way you could overcome that problem, any technical means?
No. I mean, other than just knowing that X hill is X thousand metres away.
So it's a question of judgment.
It's a question of judgment, yeah.
Were you getting intelligence from any other sources other than your recce about what the Argentinians were doing or likely to do? Because I know earlier on you said that you got some intercepts from GTHQ or other sources.
We went on getting intelligence, which I assume were intercepts. We had at this stage no air photographs at all, taken, you know, current ones. We had past ones that were taken, you know, years before, but we had no air photographs showing what the Argentine positions were, and we had no air photographs until about the last day of the war, actually, because they were so short of Harriers that they weren't about to fly air photographic missions using the Harriers. And in any case, I understand that the pods, the air photographic pods that you could fit on the GR-3s, i.e. the Air Force ones, were again not all that clever or sophisticated, and so we didn't have any air photographic information. Now, we started getting, once we made contact with the enemy, and the first time we actually made contact with the enemy was people we took from Fanning Head through interrogation. Low level intelligence, some of it which of course got out of date, like the Fanning Head people would say, well, we've got a company in San Carlos, and we'd say, yes, we know we have, you have, but they've gone. and we actually captured on about day three an Argentine OP. One of our special forces chaps had put an OP overlooking San Carlos and was actually directing aircraft down. And unfortunately, he was captured.
How did you find him?
He was found by a Marine who'd gone to have a pee and found this chap crouching behind a rock and grabbed him and pulled and brought him in.
Was it just one man on his own?
I think it was a couple of them. Yeah. Well, there was only one man on his own doing it.
Yeah.
There was only one Argentine on his own. Mm. Yeah.
So they didn't have the system of four-man patrols.
Well, it didn't seem to. Whether one man, I can't remember whether the others, whether some others in a hide further back sort of ran off having seen their chap taken. But I think there was only one on his own, as far as I know. Mm. We only got one anyway.
Mm. Did he give any information when he was caught?
No.
How had he been inserted? Had he come in by helicopter?
He'd been put by a helicopter. I could probably look it up, actually. Yeah. Forward, you know, within walking distance of where he had to go. Mm. I'll perhaps look it up later rather than any time now.
What about, were you getting any information from sources like satellite? You know, because no. The Americans had satellite.
No. The Americans, I understand, I learned later, kicked a satellite after some persuasion off its orbit into an orbit which took it over the Falklands. But a lot of the time, the areas that we were interested in were covered with cloud, so couldn't see anything. And I am not aware, even today, that any satellite imagery was available. Certainly none was made available to me.
And the other thing is SIGINT, isn't it, that you had stuff from GCHQ.
I mean, I didn't know what sources the intelligence that I was getting, it wasn't much, quite frankly, was. And it wasn't really until, I think I told you earlier, that we got some source, quite a lot of useful source from the welfare telegrams the Argentine soldiers were sending back, which were unclear. That enabled us to build up a pretty good orbat, and we got some confirmation of where what the orbat was, but that merely told us that there were X number of regiments around Stanley.
But it wouldn't tell you what they were going to be doing, what General Menendez or anyone else.
I mean, it'll come later. Mm. Our best find was when we found a map marked up with all their positions on them, which we didn't get for a long time after the time we're talking about now.
Okay, so we're really gone to about the end of day two.
Yeah, and what we did know was that they had what they called, and therefore it passed to us in this terminology, we wouldn't have called it this, their strategic reserve, which was two rifle companies strong, and nobody knew where it was. If you remember, we thought it might be at Goose Green, which is why I was so keen about it. Actually, it turned out that it wasn't there at all. And it'll come into the story later. But that was the bit that I thought was going to try and hit us, would be these two companies with quite a lot of helicopters, would be what might, you know, make our lives difficult.
Would so two companies be a strong enough force?
Well, they might have. What I think they would have been able to do was A, harass us, threaten perhaps an area which they perhaps identified, if they managed to identify it, which was easily, you know, got at. And secondly, perhaps more important, threaten our line of communication once we started moving out of the beachhead, and act as a force which could perhaps set up a hinge or a base into which they could fly perhaps a couple of battalions to actually attack our line of communication.
So set up an airhead close to the beach.
Sure.
And attack it once you'd moved towards
out.
Stanley.
Yeah, sure. Or we got people all, because I didn't think we were going to have to walk at that stage, you know, landing by helicopter in places well forward.
So you'd be strung out.
So we'd be strung out and vulnerable.
I mean, looking at it, the distances and the ground, you really didn't have sufficient men to set up a protected line of communication.
No. Oh, God, no. I mean, it was in a straight line, it was 50 miles, and wiggly, sort of, you know, about 70.
Well, that's at least a couple of divisions worth.
Quite, yes. There was no question of setting up a protected LSC at all. Yeah. No. Mm. So, I mean, by the end of day one, I was pretty satisfied, and that night, I landed my main headquarters, and by first light the next morning, I was ashore, and I felt absolutely terrific. Mm. First thing I did was my headquarters was set up, by sheer chance, by a place where there was a big flagpole, settlement sort of flagpole, from which was flying a large Union Jack, which had been hoisted the morning before by the enthusiastic Marines and appeared in all the pictures that were sent back for the newspapers. And my first order on getting ashore was to tell them to saw down the flagpole, because the last thing I wanted was a large white flagpole, either with or without a flag, marking the position of my headquarters for the enemy.
Was this in the San Carlos settlement?
This was in San Carlos settlement, yeah.
What was in your headquarters and how was it laid out?
Well, it was laid out. My headquarters consisted of a number of BV-202 bandwagons in which were the radios.
Yeah.
And so I had one, and then there was a CP, you know, a G bandwagon, and we're talking old language now, an AQ bandwagon. There was the gunner bandwagon and the sapper bandwagon and the air operations bandwagon, and so there are about six of them, and they would back into each other in a sort of cruciform type organization, over which would be thrown cam nets and joining strips of tarpaulin to keep the rain out a bit. And this was set up in among the gorse bushes, because the great thing about settlements were that they were about the only places where there was any vegetation at all, which would be imported vegetation brought in by the settlers years before, consisting of a lot of gorse and other sort of hedgery, which they'd used to sort of...
just windbreak purposes.
Windbreak, I suppose. So you could actually tuck into these things and make the thing reasonably camouflaged. And... then there was a defence troop, and then there were all the various things you'd expect in headquarters, you know, signallers and clerks and drivers and so on.
And the BV202 vehicle, this was the over-snow vehicle, wasn't it, designed for North Norway?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Did that do well over the peat?
Very well. Mm. Very well. I mean, it has the same ground pressure as a man on a pair of skis. Mm. So it's was very versatile as a result. There's a picture of them.
Oh, yes. So it's a relatively low vehicle too, isn't it?
Yep.
Low profile.
Yeah.
What was the most important element in the headquarters? Was it the sort of map table or the bank of radio sets? What?
Well, there was a map table which was manned by a duty officer.
Yeah.
Where he kept up the situation.
Yeah.
And the headquarters, the responsibility for running the headquarters was the brigade major.
Yes.
We called him then, chief
of
staff.
So he was effectively the office manager for the...
Well, he was the chief of staff of the brigade.
Yes.
And he was more than the office manager. Mm. And the office manager, I suppose, was probably the G3 ops, who worked the BM. And the BM was my chief of staff. Effectively, I mean, his equal was the DAA and QMG, who nowadays they call by as DCOS, A14 or something, who's the sort of head logistician, head personnel man. But my right hand man in the headquarters was the brigade major, the chief of staff. Mm.
And so you've got your perimeters, you've got your HQ ashore. What was your main intention for the next?
Well, what I then wanted to do was to get my logistics ashore, having seen the sort of mayhem that had gone on the day before, get it ashore before it was sunk. I mean, the night before had been really chaotic from a logistic point of view, because we were told suddenly with about 1 hour's notice that Canberra was going to be sailed. So that meant landing the rest of the field dressing station ASP into the Ajax Bay mutton factory, and even so, one surgical team never got ashore in time.
How much warning did you have that Canberra was going to be off?
About 2 hours.
That sudden.
She took with her 90,000 rations. She took with her the first line ammunition, battle batteries, rations and stores of three para 40 commando and 4-2 commando, which they never saw again till the end of the war. Norland took two paras equivalent. The first line, of course, is what isn't on the man.
Yes.
The first line is what's carried in a conventional battle in your F echelon transport. There wasn't any F echelon transport, of course.
I mean, your man carries, what, 2.5 days?
Your man would carry 2.5 plus his full ammunition load, plus a battle battery and a spare battle battery. So F echelon transport with your first line is meant to be the first top-up for when you run out of batteries, when you run out of ammunition, when you run out of food, and it acts as a buffer so that your logistics system has got some day's grace before it has to start supplying forward to get itself set up. Now, in a conventional war with wheeled transport or tracks, your F echelon goes with you. But here, there's no F echelon.
You're relying on helicopters.
You're relying on helicopters. Right? 11 helicopters support a 5,500 strong brigade. So that was an immediate problem. because these bloody stores were taken to sea and never seen until the end of the war. Mm. So that was the first thing.
What happened to the stuff that was actually got ashore in that?
Well, that was then put ashore into the logistic. What then happened was the logistic regiment, my logistic regiment, commanded by Ivar Helberg, set up in Ajax Bay, and the logistics supply, the ammunition, food and everything else was taken there, mm. and he was in charge of it, and then he was responsible for getting it forward to...
And what happened to it immediately? Was it just dumped on the beach, as it were?
Sorry,
the stuff from the Canberra?
It wasn't dumped on the beach, it was taken to sea, in the ship.
So you didn't get anything ashore from Canberra?
No. No, I mean, all of the 90,000 rations, plus all the other bits, was taken to sea in Canberra, and we never saw it again.
So where did you get stuff from?
Well, what happened was that the logistics, the second and third line logistics supplies, were then put on the beach. Well, what I'm saying is that in a normal situation, your unit first line is with you in your echelon transport, so you have control over it.
Yeah.
For example, the RSM is responsible for ammunition resupply, mm-hmm. so he knows where all the ammunition is because it's in jeeps and trucks and vehicles in your F echelon park, mm. 1,000 meters behind you. Mm. Now, we had no F echelon transport. All our F echelon stores were in boxes on board Canberra and Norland. Mm. So immediately, had there been a battle that first day, and we'd used up all the ammunition, the log regiment would have had to have started supplying us with what they had as they were getting it off the ships. And the idea of having first line is to act as, if you like, the immediate larder of supply, mm-hmm. which you use until you send to the supermarket to top it up, mm. is the best analogy. Mm. But what Canberra did was take the larder away. So we were having to go to Sainsbury's
straight away
mm. to get the stuff. Mm. But the stuff at Sainsbury's was floating about in the and had to be offloaded into the log regiment dumps before you could get at it.
Oh, was this in other merchant ships then?
It was in the LSLs, it was in other merchant ships. Mm. I mean, for example, all our first line ammunition, mm. all our war maintenance ammunition was in a ship called the Elk.
Yeah.
Now that had to be got off as well.
That's an RFA ship, isn't it?
No, the Elk was a merchant ship.
Oh, it was a merchant
ship. Yeah, it was a merchant ship. Mm. Yeah. Mm. So, it was lucky we didn't have a big battle the first day.
You'd have run out.
Well, we would have run out of immediate stocks. Yeah, mm-hmm. We would have indeed have run out.
Mm. So what policy did Ivar Helberg adopt? Did he have all the stuff brought ashore in one place and then dish it out to the various?
Yeah, he set up a logistic area ashore.
Yeah.
Around Ajax Bay, mm. Which he was trained to do. That was his job. So he had piles of mortar ammunition, piles of gun ammunition, piles of Milan ammunition, etc., set up in dumps.
On the ground?
On the ground.
Yeah.
Yeah, and he had forklifts which were landed from the LSLs and from the LPDs to move this stuff around. So... I'm going to show you a picture later. Mm-hmm. So he set up a logistic area ashore, and we then moved the field dressing station into undercover in this mutton factory. Mm-hmm. So the casualty evacuation system became that a man was wounded. He was then taken to the REP. He was then flown, usually, because there was any way to get him back, to the forward dressing station, where he was stabilised, operated on, mm. if necessary, and they carried out hundreds of operations on people to get him fit to be lifted back to the hospital ship with the Uganda.
Mm. And where was the Uganda at that stage?
Uganda was offshore. Mm. Being a hospital ship, she had to announce her position on an open radio. Her position was announced to the Argentines every day. She was painted white, had red crosses on her side, and she was lit up at night. Mm. And she was not allowed to be armed. We didn't know where she was, unless we found out. Oh. There was no secret about where she was, but it wasn't any concern of mine. Mm. except that after the Goose Green battle, for example, I asked the headquarters of the Northwood to have her moved in closer so we could cut down the
travelling time,
to get back load casualties. But what I'm trying to say is that our logistic plans were immediately thrown out of the window by the fact that we didn't have air superiority, and therefore we couldn't risk keeping our forward field dressing station on board Canberra, which was not a hospital ship, and therefore was vulnerable. We could have lost the whole thing in one. Our logistic plan, which had been relied on keeping the stuff afloat, had gone out of the window, because we'd better get it ashore quickly before it's all sunk.
Because of the air threat.
Because of the air threat. Mm. And that because of the precipitate sailing of these ships, our normal resupply system again was thrown out of the window, because we were suddenly having to go to Sainsbury's because our larder had been whipped away from under our noses.
Who'd actually decided to?
Well, this was a naval decision. Backseat driving from Northwood.
I see.
Get Canberra out.
Was this because of the prestige attached to Canberra?
I think they felt it would be a morale blow if this liner was sort of sunk and seemed to be, you know.
Could it have been a politically influenced decision as opposed to a purely service decision?
I don't know. I don't know. I don't think so. I think it was a Northwood decision.
Mm. Was Northwood aware of the effect this would have on your logistics plan?
Oh, I hadn't a clue. I mean, they didn't ask, and it would have meant absolutely nothing to them had we said it, probably.
Mm. How did the medics adjust to being suddenly put ashore into the mutton factory? Were they
all right? Because I mean, you know, my brigade medical squadron was used to working on shore, knew how to do it, and they had a parachute clearing troop as well from the parafield ambulance, who were quite used to working ashore. So they didn't find it in the least bit strange at all. You know, they were operating in entirely familiar surroundings.
How long did it take to get set up and ready to start receiving casualties?
They were set up by that night. Mm-hmm. And of course they didn't have many casualties to receive at the beginning. Most of the casualties they received at the beginning were sailors who'd been picked up by helicopters from sunken ships, brought to them first, dealt with, and then backloaded.
So you're now having to sort your logistic problems out. How long did it take before you were confident that you were going to be able to operate logistically after this withdrawal?
I would say about 4 days, because of the time it was taking to offload. And
was the offloading all by helicopter?
Mainly by landing craft and Mexifloat.
Right.
Helicopter only from decks where you were, or ships where you couldn't unload by Mexico. Most of the ferries, I mean, Norland was different. She was just an ordinary bog-standard cross-channel ferry, but people like the Elk and some of the other ships were ro-ros.
Yes.
So they had doors, and they could lower their ramps, and then landing craft, Mexes mainly, could come up to them and receive vehicles and loads, and forklifts could pick up boxes and shuttle them backwards and forwards. The trouble was that even in San Carlos water, there was always a slight swell, so they were doing that all the time.
So your forklift driver had to know what he was doing.
He had to know what he was doing, absolutely. Otherwise, he'd go for a long swim.
What sort of load could you get onto a Mexi float?
I've got the amount somewhere. I mean, I can look that up for you, but you're talking about 200 tons.
Yeah, they're big, beasts. Massive
thing. I mean, you can get sort of five, four tonners on. Mm. They're big beasts. 120 feet long, they are. So they're. In fact, you can get more than 5-4 tonners. You can get 5-4 tonners into an LC, which is much smaller. Now, Mexi will take quite a big load. I mean, I can look it up for you later.
Did the Argentines make any attempt to interfere with this logistic activity?
Oh yes.
What were they doing?
Well, they were bombing San Carlos, So that's what they tried to do.
By this stage, had you got effective air defence around the San Carlos area?
Not really.
It was still too early for the Rapier.
The Rapier was there, but it wasn't being all that effective. And the air attacks went on. I mean, most of the trouble was that most of the attacks got there before the Harriers. The Harriers used to shoot them down on the way back.
Yes.
Because the problem was no no early air warning.
No, you didn't have combat air patrol out westwards.
You couldn't afford to keep a combat air cap out up all the time. Mm. Otherwise, you know, the moment that you've just used so many aircraft on, though there was cap kept back, you couldn't have to afford to have it forward, and there was no early air warning at all. Mm. The only early air warning was a nuclear submarine sitting sort of off the Argentine coast looking through its periscope and would say there's a flight of things, you know, coming your way. Mm. So most of the aircraft were shot down by the Harriers when they'd done their business on their way back. Mm. So they'd come in, do their thing, and then go. So by that time they'd attacked you.
Did they do an enormous amount of damage?
Not as much as they could have done.
Why was that? Because they fused
the bombs wrongly.
Well, they're flying in too low.
They're flying in low, and the way the bomb fuses is a little propeller on the back.
Yes.
Which starts rotating as soon as it drops away from the aircraft. Mm. The idea of that is to make certain that it doesn't go off under you as you fly over the top. And they were fused for dropping from a certain height, which was higher than the height they actually flew. So a number of them were not completely fused when they came plunging in, and certainly a couple of LSLs had bombs dropped on them and went through them while they were sitting in San Carlos water, but the bombs were not, but because that brought everything to a grinding halt, because you had to then defuse the bomb and take it out.
Well, were they going for ships, or were they also going for the dumps on shore?
They went for the dumps on shore on the day before the Goose Green Battle, and they killed and wounded quite a large number of men in the logistic area. They blew up netted loads of ammunition, which were about to be lifted forward to Para, and destroyed those completely. So those had to be redone and sent forward. And fires and explosions went on all night throughout the night after that raid, making it rather difficult for the loggies to work, because you know they were beavering away, and a few yards away there'd be mortar ammunition exploding.
Ammunition going off.
Yeah. And they killed and wounded quite a lot of people. Mm. It was quite interesting, that, because the docks wanted me to have red crosses painted on the roof of the mutton factory. They came for permission to do it. I said no. You may not, because I was advised that I might not, because if you set up a hospital in the middle of a logistic area,
you've got to move the logistic area.
You've got to move the logistic area, because it's not kosher. Mm-hmm. So I said, we can't move the logistic area, we can't move the hospital, you've got to live with it, mate. Mm-hmm. The Argentines actually were totally naughty. They painted red crosses on everything in sight, whether it was in the middle of a logistic area or not. Mm-hmm. But we weren't going to play that same game. I mean, we had to be right. We couldn't afford to break the rules.
Did the Argentinians make any attacks on the mutton factory?
Oh, yes.
They did.
Well, that was the mutton factory they were attacking. We had two unexploded bombs in the roof of the main dressing station for the whole war.
Who was responsible for defusing these unexploded
munitions? We had sappers trained in it, bomb disposal sappers, and we also had Navy clearance divers who are trained in bomb disposal. Mm. So we had some good chaps who were very brave and did some fantastic things. I always loved the story of taking the bomb out of Lancelot, I think it was. They found difficulty in defusing it in location. So in the end, the bomb disposal boys had it lifted out, and they had a Gemini rubber boat alongside. And they said, we want to lower it into something soft. And somebody had the bright idea of filling the Gemini up with cornflakes. So they lowered this bomb onto a bed of cornflakes. And then
new technique for Kellogg's.
Exactly, and then quietly took it away and were able to defuse it sort of around the corner.
Do you think Mrs. Kellogg's are aware of this?
Probably not, actually. Mm. Probably not. It's good, and perhaps we should tell them.
Perhaps we should.
Mm. So that... And Antelope was hit Of course, she was not a logistics ship. On the third day, an effective